you can host the best backyard barbecue. When you find a professional on Angie to make your backyard the best around. Connect with skilled professionals to get all your home projects done well. Inside to outside, repairs to renovations. Get started on the Angie app or visit Angie.com today. You can do this when you Angie that.
Welcome to Kotaku Split Screen, the only podcast smart enough to just kick the extra point and go to overtime. It's September 19th, 2019, and there's video games in the air. First up, we talk about the games we're playing, from more Gears 5 to the Gears Meet Souls action of Remnant from the Ashes, to Maddie's race through Fire Emblem, to Jason's time with AI, the Somnium Files. Then we talk news from last week's report on malfeasance at indie publisher Nicholas, apparently that's how it's pronounced, Apple's new subscription game service, and rituals we perform in video games. We close out with off-topic discussion of Mindhunter, Chernobyl, the NFL, and a funky music pick. It's going to be a good one, so stick around. Welcome back to the show, everyone. As always, we're so glad that you're here to talk about video games. My name is Kirk Hamilton, and I am joined, as ever, by Mr. Jason Schreier. Hello, Jason.
Hello, Kirk.
So nice to see you. And of course, Jason and I are also joined by Maddie Myers. Hello, Maddie.
Hello, it's me.
Hello, it sure is. Nice to see you both.
You guys, so I just want to say something up top.
Sounds dramatic.
Kirk, you and I are both incredibly lucky that in our lives we will never have to be pregnant. I just want to throw that out there.
Listen, I'm not planning on it either.
I wasn't going to ask because it would be inappropriate for me to ask. But also, in that case, all three of us are very lucky that we're not ever going to be pregnant. Because
it's not
it sounds
fun,
like
from what I
living with a pregnant woman, I feel so horrible, and I'm trying to do everything I can for my wife, who is just miserable all the time, because the third trimester, and especially the last weeks, are just like, you can't sleep, you're in constant pain, you're just in constant agony from this like little human being who's sucking all the life out of you from the inside.
You're so close. She's so close. Finish line is in sight.
Any day now, right? Any day now.
So yeah,
she could interrupt this show to be like, "Honey, my
right
water broke.
I need you to take me to the hospital."
Wild. Could you imagine? I actually also found out that like the whole "my water broke" thing only happens some of the time.
Sometimes they have to do it for you.
Yeah, it's that's just one of the signs that you're going into labor. It could also be a bunch of other things.
But it's a perfect sitcom setup, so let's just assume it happens every time.
It works out nicely. Well, it's also sort of like, well. Can I say something really gross?
Yeah, of course. All of this is gross.
I was watching The League last night, and it made me think one of my kind of weird pet peeves about sitcoms or any TV shows is that like when they show two people having sex and they finish, it's never really realistic like sex finishing because they always just like roll to the sides and it's like, oh, okay, we're done.
Also, they're like, always mysteriously still wearing their underwear.
Their underwear, I was about to say. That's the thing I always notice. They wake up in the morning and everyone's got their underwear on. I'm like, okay.
But also, any adult who has had sex knows that there's some cleanup
there are
involved.
Other things that happen
afterwards that is never actually shown on a TV show, and I always find it really weird. And obviously
it's really
they're not
going to
show.
Why
obviously
don't
they're
show
not going to show some of that stuff. But it's like if you're going to go
like
through,
they like have
the
they like don't want to show everything.
I know it's odd. And why don't they show people saying hello every time they pick up the phone, and also every
true.
Bathroom break? Like I
and
don't know.
Saying
TV's
goodbye
terrible.
when they hang up the phone. There are so many things like
terrible,
that.
Terrible.
But if you're gonna show a bathroom break, you show like the all of it. Well, I guess
great point. Great point.
Anyway,
this
is all
show.
To say
here we
that
are.
Thanks, everyone. Kotaku Split Screen. Leave us a review if you like what you hear.
And any minute now, I could be called into father duty. This is either going to be my last episode for a while, or next week will be my last episode for
second
a while.
Second last.
And then I'll be gone for another 4 weeks of my first chunk of paternity leave. So goodbye in advance and see ya. See ya. And if I suddenly disappear, if you all suddenly stop, if I like suddenly stop talking on this episode,
oh man, we're gonna roll the tape through that.
But Kirk and I won't acknowledge it if that happens. If Jason just stops,
that would be podcast gold. We've got to get that. Amanda bursts into the room. Jason, it's time.
What if we did a live recording from the hospital?
You run that by your wife. You see what she thinks of that.
See what Amanda thinks of that.
You let us know.
It'll just be me like talking about Link's Awakening, and you just hear in the background like,
she's like screaming in the background, cursing your name, and you're like, so this cool side quest with the witch. Let me just go over this for you guys. Let me just explain to you how to do it. That'll be great. Great.
Sounds like good content to me.
Anyway, should we talk about some video games?
Let's do it.
Yeah.
Okay.
Sure.
I want to start with something new because I haven't really talked about this game yet. And it is a little game called AI The Somnium Files. Have you guys heard of this game outside of me?
No, but it has such a weird distinctive name that it's just completely stuck in my brain as a game you're playing. So tell me
I feel like this game has not been marketed very well because a lot of people don't know that it's coming. And I was like a little bit surprised when I first heard about it. But this is from the director of the Zero Escape games, which are 999 and Virtue's Last Reward and Zero Time Dilemma, which are fantastic trilogy of visual novels by this director named Uti Choshi. And he's just grown this reputation for like creating all these super captivating twisty visual novels that are full of like random tangents about science and mythology and really crazy plots that involve parallel universes and time travel and all sorts of like cool twists and interesting stuff. And I've always loved the Zero Escape games and was pleasantly surprised to find that he has this new game that just came out this week. And I played about 9 or 10 hours and it's really, really good. It's really interesting. Enjoyable, because I know that both of you need new games to add to your list. I had to tell you about it, but yeah, it's the story is that you play as this detective named Date, and you find this woman who has been murdered on a carousel in the middle of this old abandoned park, and she has her left eye gouged out. And it turns out that you are also missing a left eye, and in your left eye instead, you have this AI machine called Aiba, who is both your constant companion, your police companion who cracks wisecracks, and also is like a multi-tool that can do all sorts of police work for you. You like okay, an
quick
X-ray,
question.
X-ray.
Quick question. Is Aiba spelled IBA or EYE hyphen BA?
No, so it's AIBA.
Oh, and it's boy.
Okay, so it's got AI.
Because it's
in
also
there
an
well.
AI. Wow. But it's
yeah,
because
it's
your
also
eye.
An AI and it's a nickname.
That's a thick pun.
Nickname for eyeball and also eyeball. Yeah, this game is like all of Utikoshi's games. Utichoshi's games are full of like weird puns and wordplay and stuff like that, localized very well, I will say. So he embarks on this investigation and winds up in this big twisty story full of all sorts of weird characters and new mysteries and questions about his past. And then just like in Zero Escape, Virtue's Last Reward, I don't know if you guys have played it. Kirk, I think you might have played it, or you only played 999.
No, I played some both of them. Those two, yeah.
Yeah, so Virtue's Last Reward unfolds on this giant flowchart, and like every time you make a decision, it can go in one of two branches, and then you, in order to finish the game, you have to see every possible branch, so you're constantly zooming around the flowchart, and then the story delves into that, and like, uh-oh, can you suddenly start to remember things you've seen in other timelines? And so that's the main story of like Virtue's Last Reward. And then so this game also has a flowchart and also has branching paths. And I started to see some of those same familiar patterns. Like I got to the end of one path and it was like locked until you reveal more of the story. And so I had to go back and like go down a different path. And it's doing some really interesting narrative stuff. There's also nice. A puzzle element to it that isn't quite as good as the Zero Escape puzzles. It's
yeah,
more
what's
of like
the,
a weird...
'Cause I always think of the Zero Escape games as being like Room Escape puzzles. I like that part of those games.
Yeah. I really
like
this.
So is this
like
that
too.
Or is it like crime scene investigation or?
No, so neither. So it's most of the game is you talking to people, and unlike the Zero Escape games, you have branching dialogue or rudimentary branching dialogue because you wind up having to see all the different outcomes regardless, but you can choose options and you're going around talking to people and clicking on things to investigate them on the screen. That's most of the game. But then there are these like dreamscape portions that are called Somnium, and that's where the name AI, the Somnium Files comes from. Okay. And basically you use iBot and this machine to like go into someone's mind and try to figure out what their hidden secret is, or try to do something. You have different goals in each
somewhat
one.
Phoenix Wright-esque. You're unlocking the chains around their heart.
Well, it's not quite like that, because you actually walk around and like you control as suddenly this human version of Aiba who walks around right. in this
dreamscape. I just mean like conceptually.
Conceptually, sure, yeah. And then you see all these different objects. They're like, there might be a handful of objects. Here, let me set the scene by giving you guys an example. So at one point, someone is murdered. A woman is murdered, and you think it's by a man. So you go into this man's mind, and you suddenly see this like depiction of a warehouse. And you can walk around this warehouse, and look, over here, there's a box. And over here, there's a control panel for a crane. And if you go up to the control panel, then you have a couple of options. And one of them might be pull lever, and one of them might be push lever. And then one of them is do a video game code on all the different levers, and yeah, the correct option is do the video game code. But here's the catch. Each of these things takes up time. You have a limited amount of time in each of these somniums. I think it's 6 minutes. And so like pulling the lever might cost you 30 seconds, and then pushing the lever might cost you 30 seconds. So it's not actual real time. It's more like a currency mm-hmm. that you're using to solve the puzzles, right? And so it's a lot of trial and error, because there's no real indications of like, oh, I need to do the video game code thing with all these levels rather than pushing them or pulling them. It's a lot of just like, I'm going to randomly guess what to do. But it's kind of fun. It's like got this weird. I found myself retrying a couple of times because I just ran out of time because I made the wrong decisions. But it gets pretty zany and wacky, and you do some weird stuff in people's dreams. And then so it's within those that the branching happens, because you can choose to do different things. Like at one point, you can choose whether to believe someone's story or not believe it. And then choosing each one will send you down a different path in the story. And then once you followed that path to its conclusion, then once you follow that branch to its conclusion, you have to go back and see what the other way would do. And then to finish the story, I assume, I have not finished it, but I assume I'm gonna have to see everything, and then there will be some major like groundbreaking twist at the end, like there always is. And I'm really excited, because it's like a really captivating mystery and story. It's all about it's a serial killer and a string of murders, and they always gouge out the left eye of the person, and there are a lot of like questions about parallel universes and a lot of themes, like a lot of talk about Egyptian mythology and the way that they explored eyes. And there's a glossary in the game, and anyone who's played one of the Zero Escape games knows all about the random tangents about like, we're gonna get into Ice Nine and like Schrodinger's cat and random shit. And in this game there's a glossary, and it's almost like a joke for anyone who's played those games, because you like dig through it and it's all these random little things. It's like Freemasons like just random scientists, like,
so it's
Egyptian,
all like folklore
Osiris.
Things, because it's like it's related not, to,
and also science. It gets okay. into he loves exploring both mythology and science, and just like diving into these topics. But it's always fascinating, and the writing is fantastic, and that's really what keeps it going. The one caveat here is that there are a lot of like sex jokes, lewd sex jokes, that are often really bad sex jokes, or really just like jarring sex jokes, where like the main character is just hitting on people for no reason, and it can take you out of the story a little bit. But that's just part of the charm of this guy's games, sure. and has been since
part
since,
of the anti-charm.
Yeah,
people for no reason.
Part of the charm in quotes, depending on if you
sure.
like it or not. But I find that it's all done in good spirit. Like, it never feels like, from what I've seen so far, at least, the sex jokes and the lewd jokes, none of it is really cruel. It's more just like weird and off-putting a little bit, but not mean-spirited. And like, he feels like there's a thing that went viral on Twitter this morning. That's just one of the characters delivering this heartfelt speech about LGBT people and how the struggles they've gone through, and how we should respect them. And it's really, it was cool to see, because Japanese culture has had some issues with that sort of thing. So anyway, AI, the Somnium Files, I'm playing it on Switch. Some technical issues on Switch, but not a big deal. It's also out on PC and PS4. Really cool game. If you're into visual novels, Phoenix Wright, Danganronpa, Zero Escape, I recommend it. Check it out. What about you, Maddie? What are you playing?
Well, I downloaded and installed Control, but I have not so much as started it because
you're gonna
I can't
like it.
Stop playing Fire Emblem, and
well, that's
it's
good too.
Becoming a problem. There were some nights when I stayed up significantly later than I intended to, because this game really allows you to do that. I'll just do one more thing activity, but like 1,000 times. Like, I can't even start talking to someone at the monastery without talking to literally everyone at the monastery. And then doing every single side quest at the monastery.
Have you gotten to the time skip yet?
No, I'm like 20 hours in. I don't know how close or far I am to that exactly. Yeah, I guess it depends on how many auxiliary battles I want to do, which I did a ton of them because I don't actually like the battle system very much. I'm kind of with you, Jason, and feeling like it's not deep enough, but also the things that are hard about it are just not interesting to me personally. Mm-hmm. And it really speaks to how much I enjoy the rest of the game that even though a huge part of this game is these tactical battles that I'm not particularly enjoying, I'm still super into it. So that says something about how enjoyable I think the characters are, I think.
To answer your question real quick, you can actually, there's like a little cheat that you can use to figure out when the time skip is coming, and that is the paralogue battles will all say like, this is available until this date, and that's pretty much
it. Is that a cheat? I just kind of
that's when it's coming up. And, you know, I did wonder about that. I was like, okay. I don't know how much many more months I have of teaching people before my time to recruit
That's the thing. It's useful to know, because at a certain point I was like, all right, you know what? I'm going to spend the rest of my free time just training my skills so then I can go recruit people,
recruit as many people as possible. Yeah. I mean, I haven't really been as organized about that as I could have been, because I just am enjoying talking to people and haven't really been as tactical about it. But this past week, now that I'm not playing as much Gears to review anymore, I was kind of like, all right, let me like really try to look at my skills and actually teach people subjects that make any goddamn sense. And I like did a bunch of auxiliary battles so that people were properly leveled up and really tried to read all of those gazillions of menus about what everything in the game does, even though it is something that I've up until this week been largely ignoring and just kind of skating by, which you can kind of do in this game, but you kind of can't. Like when I got to the Death Knight, I was like pretty underleveled because I just hadn't been giving a shit at all. And the first time you get to that guy, I know you fight him like a bajillion times, but I was definitely like sucking and being like, well, everyone's loadouts are terrible. I'm not putting anyone in the right spot and I'm just not giving a crap about this fight. So how about I actually set up my entire item loadout, make sure everyone has the critical arts that they should have and like are standing in the right place. Like, I don't know. I wish I cared about that part, because I care so much about all of the adorable children in this game. And I'm like really rooting for them and loving that part so much. But then when we're on the battlefield, I'm just like, guys, I don't know. Just like go towards the enemy. Funny. Like do whatever you're going to do. I couldn't be bothered.
You're a golden deer. Is that right on this first time?
I am golden deer. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. I wonder if over time that'll change. I found that like the more I got to know the characters, the more I enjoyed watching them on the battlefield, even while, you know, as we talked about it, the game wasn't really that challenging except for a couple of times. It was just fun to know, imagine these two characters that I like teaming up and fighting together.
That part is fun. And like now that I'm getting more and more of the rewards from those battles and like remembering like, oh yeah, those two characters did work together more. And I'm like observing that that's helping them. I'm not a Fire Emblem person, obviously. So all of this is kind of new to me.
Right.
But the other part of it is there's also that, well, there's the mock battle between the students like very, very early on in the game, but I just did the second one.
Oh yeah, that one's good.
Fairly recently, where you're like, you have to kill other people. And I was like, well, by this point, I know who they are. Well, you're not really killing them, not yet.
Right.
But like, you have to fight them and it seems like they're dying. And it's like, how the heck would this mock battle possibly work in real life?
You could using wooden swords really or something.
Do you have permanent death on?
I don't. I'm not even, I don't care. I was literally like, I'm playing for the story, which is shit because it means that everyone is alive and I can play the battles as poorly as I want and no one will ever die, which I actually think I'm losing something by doing it. Like I'm playing it on whatever the two easy modes are. I can't remember what they're called. It's like casual and normal, mega casual and like baby mode. Like I'm playing it on that. So
yeah,
like,
there's enough like rewind mechanics. There's all this stuff built in that lets you undo that.
Yeah, and it's normal so much.
Yeah, it's
the game
easy
is carrying me across it. And I'm still like, this is too hard. I hate these battles. But it's funny. I'm still like super enjoying the game. And I definitely recommend it just for anyone who likes reading stuff. And I like saving up all my support conversations and like propping my Switch up while I'm brushing my teeth and like watching them at night. Like they're my stories. I'm really enjoying that part of it. So yeah, it's a good game. Anyway, nice. Kirk, what are you playing?
Well, I'm playing two games. that are sort of related to one another and are both good. So I'm playing Gears 5 for starters. And I wasn't really expecting to play it, but then I started playing it. And I'm also playing a game called Remnant from the Ashes, which is a video game name. You would be shocked to hear.
It sure is.
Something called Remnant from the Ashes is a video game, but it is. And that game is also very good. This was a
couple
listeners.
Is that the game we've got a bunch of people asking us about? Yeah.
Yeah.
A couple
I think
listeners
so.
Have said to play it, and a couple other people outside have just, I've seen people talking about how it's really good and sort of under the radar. So yeah, I thought I'd play it. I would describe Remnant from the Ashes as Gears of Dark Souls. I wasn't sure whether Souls of War or Gears of Dark Souls would be the way that I would describe it. But it's Dark Souls with guns. It's not exactly Dark Souls with guns. There are different things, but it has it's very Dark Souls-y, Dark Souls inspired.
Mm-hmm. Bloodborne is already Dark Souls with guns. So,
But this is like Dark Souls as a shooter. Like it's like you shoot over the shoulder like Resident Evil style and like shoot things in the head with like a machine gun.
Or Gears
gun,
of War
like.
Style. Yeah.
Yeah, Gears of War style, right. So let me think. How should I talk about these? Let's talk about Gears 5 first, since you and I have both played that game. So I like it. I'm really just playing it for the campaign. I don't love Gears multiplayer. We talked about that a little bit last week, and I'm not that good at Gears. So maybe I'll talk about that a little bit. Or like, I don't find that I am.
You
able...
can play it on easy, and it's real easy because I gave it a little test drive on some of the different difficulty modes in the campaign, and easy mode is. I mean, okay, I shouldn't talk this way because, you know, different difficulty levels are different for different people. But for me, at least, Gears on easy is like the difference between easy and intermediate, I find to be a wide gulf in that game.
Which is cool because there should be a mode for people because the story is actually really good. And
sure,
it's pretty,
I kind of feel like there should be more modes, but it doesn't matter. That's a separate conversation.
Yeah. So, well, and when I say I'm not good at Gears, it isn't like I actually normally play these games on hard because I find that that's like the most... I don't know, like the one above normal. I'm just playing this one on normal because I just don't really care and like I'm soloing it. If I play with somebody else, I'll definitely play on hard because
if you have someone else,
who can like revive you. But it's not so much that like I have a hard time, especially because I'm playing with a mouse and a keyboard on PC, which I've never done with Gears before. But I can like when I have a sniper rifle at this point, it's just ridiculous. Like because it's just kind of not. It's made to be played with a controller, and you can just own people with that incredible sniper. Rifle that Gears is it the long shot? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, there is one called that. Yeah. I like the Marksa, I think it's
called. Oh, is that the like electric
the other
one?
Sort of alternate sniper rifle that doesn't make you reload every shot. I like that
one. Right. Yeah, so with a mouse, it's just like you just delete people off
pew,
of
pew.
Like bad guys, especially on normal. Yeah. So it's not hard in that way. It's more like moving around has never felt right to me. It feels like, and this is the closest analogy I can come up with. It feels like those puzzles where you have the marble or like the ball bearing in the maze and you have to move the maze and the ball bearing like rolls around. That's what my character feels like when I'm playing Gears. I wonder if anybody listening to this will relate to that. It's like, the moving around is just a little weird. There's a shift between when you're just moving, like you're kind of jogging, and then you do the roadie run, and suddenly you become like really like momenticized or whatever, and you're sticking to things, and you like you start moving in a maybe slightly unexpected direction, like 10 degrees to the left or right of where I wanted. And that is just, I've just never quite gotten good at it. Even though I've played a lot of Gears and I like playing Gears, it's just never quite been something that I've adjusted to. And actually playing Remnant at the same time has been sort of interesting because moving around in that game is a little closer to a Souls game. You don't stick to cover in Remnant. You move around kind of slowly, but you can sprint, but that drains your stamina. But you're very responsive and like it's a very snappy feeling game. And I don't know, I find it much more masterable and easier to play than Gears in some ways, even though Gears is so beautiful looking and kind of really high production value and satisfying in so many ways and like, you know, shooting things and they turn into meat and it's all very cool. And they're very, you know, they're kind of very different games in a lot of ways. One is like a big set piece AAA shooter and one is more like Dark Souls with guns, but they have similar control styles. And I'm actually finding that I'm way smoother, like I'm way better at playing Remnant, which when I've been kind of jumping back and forth between them, sort of breaking my one game at a time rule and finding like it, sometimes I just get whiplash from it. So that's something I'm adjusting to.
So wait, so does Remnant have like big boss fights and like tough?
Yeah.
And like a story and big
fancy
cutscenes?
Can you talk about what makes it like Dark Souls?
Yeah, let me finish up about Gears 5 maybe, and then I'll actually talk about Remnant because I want to talk about that game just on its own terms. It's really good. I really like it. But so Gears 5 anyways, a couple other thoughts. I do like the story. Like I've said, I've made this disclosure, but like I know the guy who wrote the game, so like that's a fair disclosure that I'm, I guess, biased. But I think it's good. Like there's just good writing. The characters are believable. There was a scene. There's a scene kind of early on. So Kate, the character that you're playing, and JD, who's the character you played in the last game, they just have this little exchange where, you know, Kate has this sort of locust heritage, and that's part of the theme of the story, as you've mentioned, Maddie. And it's like about her identity, and you play as her for most of the game. And they're having this kind of argument or discussion in a cutscene, and she says something, and he's like, well, you would feel that way, kind of implying that she's not like the rest of them. And she's just like, that was a really shitty thing to say. And he's like, you're right, I'm sorry. And it's this, the way it's acted, the way that it's written, it was like a really cool exchange. It was a really little thing, but there's a lot of dialogue in the game that's like that, where people mm-hmm. will reference things they said before in like just normal human ways. They just kind of feel like yeah. human beings in a way they haven't before.
I think a lot of it is the timing and delivery of those lines too. Mm-hmm. Like JD has that pause where he sort of reflects, and they show mm-hmm. the character reflecting on it and being like, yeah, you're right, that was shitty. And I feel like games screw up timing a lot. Like yeah. Fire Emblem does this a lot, where if you just let the cutscenes go, like characters deliver their lines at really weird pacing. Yeah. We make fun of Kingdom true. Hearts for doing this all the time as well. But a lot of games have this issue where like the lines just aren't happening at the right times. Mm-hmm. But Gears 5, I think, really nailed that. Like the timing of the line deliveries, and even in where you're just walking around and characters say lines to you,
yeah.
the cadence of them I found to be very real seeming, and it's mm-hmm. a small thing, but it makes a big difference.
In fairness, with the Japanese games, they usually have to deal with lip flaps, and that's the reason the timing is always off.
Byleth doesn't even talk, so what's their excuse there? No, I'm just kidding.
I've noticed that also. I'm in Act 2 now, which is really cool. You're playing, I'm Kate, I'm in like the open world. I'm going around with Del, who I also really like Del is just a good character in this one, and their conversations are also really good when they're on that cool like sailboat, like
yeah, the like snowmobile jet ski thing that they're on. That thing is so fun to drive too.
It is. I find and it's it very so satisfying. Gears. I feel like it's so Gears that instead of a snowmobile, it's this weird, to describe this thing to listeners, it's like one person sits up front in what looks like a snowmobile, and then another person stands on a long like ski rail that goes out the back, and then holds these two like ropes that go up to this massive parasail that hangs in front of it, like a kind of a parachute. And then yeah. you get pulled along by the wind. So the person in the back is like steering with these two ropes that are attached to a parachute.
Yeah, so they're like roller skating basically mm-hmm. through this Arctic wasteland on this jet ski, essentially.
So it's totally like a wind.
Macho as heck.
And it's so like, this is a world where the grenades like have chains on them and they swing them around and throw them. Like it's a world where things are designed to be mechanically cool, but not mm-hmm. the same as they are here.
And like not
Sarah
practical
is.
At all. No, but just cool. Dance-like. Yeah.
Yeah. So it has that vibe. So I like that. And then the one other thing that I really like that they've added to this game is you can do an active reload at any time. You
yes.
can just do one,
yes.
and it's so good.
Just,
I don't know why they didn't do this earlier.
You can just do it again.
You can just do it again.
Endlessly do it.
It's so good. So you can have a full magazine, and then you just load it up with power bullets.
Yes, but it's so satisfying.
Kind of,
so
but like you still have to do it in the heat of battle, and it still has that exciting feeling. But yeah, then you can just load up before a battle and like load up with powerful bullets. Love it. I love that you can just do it at any time and there's no penalty. Like, I'm surprised they didn't do that earlier.
Yeah, I mean, the penalty is still that you're reloading in the middle of a firefight, so like it's still difficult to do, but they do let you do it at any time, which I think, I don't know, I found it better. I think
it's nice. So it lets you kind of get ready to fight if you know you're going into a fight. Anyway, I like it. It's beautiful looking too. It's interesting mm-hmm. to play it right so soon after Control, which is, I would say Control is beautiful in a different way. Gears 5 is like, feels like an Unreal Engine showcase. It's gorgeous looking, but it's not, like, it just looks like a very beautiful version of things I've seen before, where mm-hmm. Control has this look of like, this is like something new. This feels different. And it's partly uh-huh. just, you know, being part of a long series that has a certain look that's always been kind of an Unreal Engine. And yep. like, just, it looks like an Unreal tech demo sometimes, like a really amazing one, but it still is like those same interiors and exteriors, where Control is like this whole different art direction. But both games feel very like cutting edge on PC, like holy crap graphics, man. So anyways, I like it. I'm going to play the whole thing. It's fun. It's like a fun, it's like playing an Uncharted game kind of. It just is like this good story with good action. So let me talk really quickly about Remnant now. Remnant from the Ashes. So this game, mm-hmm. I already described it, Gears of Dark Souls, sort of. It's made by Gunfire Games, which is an Austin-based studio. They made Darksiders 3, and they made a VR game called, it's called Chronos. And it was an Oculus Rift exclusive that came out with the Oculus Rift that actually played, and it was a little bit Dark Souls-y. It was like a melee combat game, and it was actually really slick and had all these cool ideas. I probably talked about it like however many years ago when this came out. It had this concept like, like where if you died, you got older and your character would get older and they would gain different abilities as they got older. So it was like there was this penalty for death because like time would pass each time you would die and your character would become like an old person by the end of the game. There were these like interesting ideas in it, which was unusual at the time of like a VR launch game, because most of those games were just like, here, it's kind of like Mario, but you're in VR. So that's like enough to make it special, where this game actually had cool ideas and could have just been a cool game on its own. It just happened to put you in VR. What's wild about Remnant when I started playing it was I looked at it and there are these glowing rocks that you use kind of like bonfires in Dark Souls. They're like a save point and you travel with them. And the first time I saw one, I was like, that looks familiar. And it's the same rock from that game Chronos, because Remnant takes place in the same universe as the game Chronos, which I didn't even know. Even when I was playing it, I didn't know that. And then I looked it up and they're like, yeah, they're in the same universe. And I think they're reusing some assets too, which is smart because not that many people probably played their VR game, and a lot of people are playing Remnant.
Right. I wonder which conversation came first. Like, can we reuse these assets, or this,
sure,
is this in the same universe?
Yeah. And also, like, it's a cool universe. Like, like I said, Chronos was kind of surprising because it had all these neat ideas and interesting stuff. Like, the people making it were just kind of operating on a higher level. They were, like, really making something cool. So it makes sense that they'd be like, well, we had all these cool ideas. Let's build on them some more and, you know, and make a game that people will actually play, like Gears of War, Dark Souls. Yeah, so this game is, like I said, you move around. It feels very Soulsy. It's like got that same rhythm where you're playing very cautiously. Enemies, like regular enemies, can really mess you up. There is melee combat. There is shooting. You kind of pick one of three character classes. And there's a lot of just that same feeling of going around and, you know, really hoarding items and trying to get as many pickups as you can and being careful. It's got some cool twists, though. There are, like, the differences from Dark Souls are significant. There's no penalty for death, so you don't, like, lose XP in that Dark Souls way, which is a huge difference, right? Like, that totally changes the, like, risk calculus that you're making when you're playing. It's got real guns, like, not like a Dark Souls bow, but just full-on, it is a shooter. So there are just waves of enemies coming at you, and you're shooting at them. It's also a three-person. It can be played with up to three people, so it can be just co-op the whole way through.
Wait, it has waves? It has, like, spawning waves of enemies?
Well, so, yeah, and that's another big difference. So this game has some Left 4 Dead qualities to it that are also sort of interesting. I'm not totally sure all the particulars here, but there's some, it's not random generation exactly of levels, but the campaign itself is put together in a procedurally generated way, where there will be an area that I don't
just
believe
lost
is
all interest whatsoever.
Well, let me explain it though, because this is important. The area itself, you'll go to an area that is not procedurally generated. It has been designed, you know, by hand. But then the next area you get to will be one of two or three possibilities. And each of those is also handmade. So you're not walking through like identical boring levels. It's just you're going to different dungeons in a different order. And the bosses that you fight might be in a different order as well. So there are some elements, like I think that bosses might have different buffs and stuff that change. And then also the game will occasionally throw different types of enemies at you. You'll hear this sound that's very Left 4 Dead. This like high note will play and you'll get kind of attacked by a sort of mini boss. It's kind of Diablo-ish almost. Like it'll be like a tough enemy surrounded by a bunch of mobs that come at you and you have to deal with them. And then once you kill them, you know, there's another tone and your character will be like, oh, it's over. I made it. And that adds a sort of a Diablo quality. This you're always kind of on edge, which feels a little bit like the AI director in Left 4 Dead. I would imagine playing this with a group.
It's kind of Gearsy though as well though, to like have, I mean, there aren't the procedural generation, but Gears encounters are so much like a wave of enemies and you wait until you hear the tone of music that's like, well,
yeah,
that's over now.
Yeah.
Like it's very, I mean, it's why Horde mode feels like such a natural fit for that game, because it's like the same as the campaign. You're just fighting another wave.
It has that feeling for sure. And it's really cool. I really like it. It's sort of, you know, it doesn't feel quite like super AAA. It's really pretty looking and it plays really well, but it's clearly like made by a slightly smaller studio, but it has that kind of charm to it. And I gather the beginning is a little boring, like the areas are kind of boring looking. I gather it gets much more interesting. I saw a video of like higher level play in this game and it was just crazy the stuff that was going on. You get these charms on your guns that like when they're charged up you can like, or when they're charged up you can fire crazy spells off and do all this really gnarly stuff. And I think the areas, like the you know, environments you're exploring get super crazy. So it looks cool. I think I'm going to finish Gears because I know Gears is like finishable, but I do kind of want to keep playing it. Like I find myself very drawn into it because I like the rhythm of it more than the rhythm of Gears. Gears is like a very the campaign anyways, is this very like AAA set piece to set piece, like moving through a very predictable kind of a thing. This is much more of that kind of unknowable, that challenge, the exploration, the just sort of seeing what's going to happen and customizing my character build that Dark Souls has. And I like that feeling, even though there are, like I said, there are some significant differences from Dark Souls. So it's a really cool game. I'm glad people urged me to play it.
Yeah, sounds interesting. Remnant from the Ashes. So that's on PC and consoles, right?
Yeah.
Cool. All right, why don't we take a break and then we will talk about some other video game related topics.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And we are back. Kirk, Maddie, let's talk about a little bit of news and then answer a listener question. Although I don't know if I have any satisfying answers to that, but we'll get to that. First of all, let's talk about Nicholas. Have either of you, or had either of you, heard of Nicholas before last week?
Yes. I had.
I had seen the name and had heard of them, but not in any capacity related to your story. And I also did not know how to pronounce them until right now. So
same.
Now I
know. I thought it was Nicholas until right now, but it's Nicholas.
Now
great.
You know.
Good, cool.
So Nicholas is a video game publisher started by a man named Tyrone Rodriguez, who used to work at IGN and left in, I think, 2007. Nicholas is best known for publishing Cave Story and Binding of Isaac, among other games. Not the original versions of either of those games, but ports, console ports later on. They wound up getting NX, which would become Switch dev kits really early. So they wound up getting a lot of games on Switch and making a lot of money there. But before that, they were bringing games to PC and 3DS and DS and Wii and all the other platforms. There have been rumors around that company for a while. There have been a lot of questions about like the way they treat people and the way they announce things and then don't follow up on them, or things just fall through the cracks and disappear. And lots of people have been wondering about Nicholas for a long time. Last week, we published a story that talked to a whole bunch of people who have worked either for Nicholas as employees or with Nicholas as developers. And the results were not very good. Tyrone Rodriguez, the head of Nicholas, has a history of making super racist comments and jokes in chat logs involving that the company, like company chat logs, so not like privately with his friends, which I mean still bad, but this is actually within the company where he is the boss and making these jokes to his employees. I'm just usually like throwing around racial slurs. I wound up seeing a bunch of Skype logs. I shared some of them in this Kotaku article, but I've actually seen a ton more that are just like him being like Jews, and like dropping like F words and other horrible things, calling people like you gays, or like coming into work and saying hero like in an Asian accent, like that sort of thing, in a stereotypical like a Vietnamese accent he would use. But that's just the kind of tip of the iceberg. There's also been all sorts of accusations from people who have worked with him about him and the company ghosting on them, agreeing to sign deals with developers, and then just never following up or answering phone calls or emails. And other problems involving staff. People said he was a very controlling and exploitative boss. He would tell people, he would like pressure people into drinking heavily on work trips and like yell at them if they wouldn't do what he said, if they wouldn't come with him on various excursions. One person told the story of this guy was overweight and he was pressured into like going around with them in Japan, with Tyrone and his brother in Japan, and got to the point where he was walking so much that his like thighs were chafing and started bleeding. And he was like, I can't do this anymore. I can't walk anymore. And the two of them were like, you have to come with us on this new trip, going to a shrine or something like that, or a museum or something. And he was like, no, I can't. And they got so mad at him that he thinks that as a result, they fired him. All sorts of horror stories like that. You can read the story on Kotaku. During the course of my reporting for this story, I actually reached out to Edmund McMillan, who is the creator of Binding of Isaac, and he was like, oh my God, this is horrifying. I'm not going to be working with Nicholas again. And he kind of pulled out of the deal for his future stuff with Nicholas. So yeah, just a debacle all around, and it kind of speaks to bigger picture, the way that like a person in a position of power, especially when they're the only owner of a company and like have this trend. One of the trends that I noticed was that they would hire people or work with people who didn't have a lot of prestige in the video games industry, whether it was people who it was their first jobs and he kind of found them on the internet because they were showing cool art or something like that, or developers that haven't made games before. Like, for example, there was a story publicly about this guy who I think is like 25 years old. He made this game called Save Me, Mr. Taco. It's like this Game Boy styled octopus game. And he had actually, someone had tweeted at him, like, what's the deal with this game? And he said he had a patch ready and Nicholas wouldn't release it. And then Tyrone Rodriguez like tweeted back at them being like, this game didn't sell well enough, so we're not going to release the patch because we don't want to put in the money to do it. So like that's an example of like the type of developer that they often work with, just first time developers who like don't have a lot of power. This was this guy's first game. So yeah, it just seems like a debacle all around, and it speaks to the power that one person can have over a lot of people and the shittiness that can come as a result of that.
Yeah, although in this case it's in the indie scene, which is interesting because I feel like we don't always end up in a situation where we're seeing somebody in a position of power as an indie dev, and that's part of why the story I thought was good to do, because it's hard to rise in that scene, but it's also hard to succeed as well. So I don't know, it was just an interesting layer of it as a
reader. they're a savvy publisher, and what they did was smart, which was help. So Cave Story, I don't know if you guys know the history of this game, or have either of you played Cave Story?
Because yeah, I've talked about it on the show many times.
Yeah. So Cave Story, so you know how it is, Kirk. So Cave Story is awesome, but Cave Story actually started off as a freeware game, and that was released on PC in like 2004 or something. And what Tyrone Rodriguez did wisely was recognize how good it was and talk to the guy involved and packaged it as something they could sell. And so they started selling it on WiiWare, and you remember WiiWare back in the day, and like DS, and wound up selling it on all the different platforms. And that made them a ton of money because it's a phenomenal game that just sold really well all across the board. They wound up doing like revised versions like Cave Story Plus and stuff like that. So it's a savvy, and same thing with Binding of Isaac, similar story. So it's a savvy approach that they took. But just sad debacle all around. Kirk, any thoughts before we move on?
No, I think that not really. People tend to build power structures around themselves if they're kind of boundary pushers, in the way it kind of seems like this guy is, like across everything in your article. I just got the sense this is someone who enjoys pushing up against people's boundaries and saying things that are out of line, and maybe a little bit out of line, or maybe a lot out of line, and like making people do things that they don't want to do just to kind of like exercise that power over and over again. And like, it seems as though the whole thing was almost constructed around that, or at least can be seen that way. And that's fucked up. So it's good that people were willing to talk about it. And I appreciated reading the story. I agree with Maddie. It was interesting. It felt different than a lot of the sorts of stories that you write. And I appreciated that.
Yeah, and I'm super grateful to those people who did speak with me, even knowing that like Nicholas was a small company and it could be risky to speak out. And Tyrone Rodriguez has a history of just like, because that kind of boss often uses their power to threaten and cajole people, it can be scary to like speak out against them. So,
especially if you're like a 25-year-old dev who hasn't actually shipped a game yet, and maybe you're working with this company, like it's the people who are least likely to speak out.
The other big news story of the past week is the Apple Arcade, which actually comes out this Thursday, I believe today, the day that this podcast is going live. Apple Arcade goes live, and Apple Arcade is this fascinating concept. I don't know how much you guys guys know about it, but it's basically you have to pay Apple $5 a month, and in exchange you get a ton of games, including like 30 brand new original games that Apple has commissioned just for this, like a game from the people who made Bravely Default, and like a game from Capybara Games, and a game from Zach Gage, and some
other
folks.
A new Simogo game. That's the one I'm excited about. A new Simogo game. That Sayonara Wild Hearts. That game sounds
dope.
Oceanhorn 2, a sequel to that Zelda-like game, and a ton of others I'm forgetting. Like, the number of games on this thing is out of control. $5 a month, you get it. You can play them on iPhone at first, and then later you're going to be able to play them on Apple TV and then Mac, which is cool. You can now use PS4 and Xbox One controllers on iPhone, so you could play with an actual controller, which is really good, because a lot of people, myself included, aren't thrilled with like trying to play traditional console games on touch controls. Yeah. It cannot be great.
So, and you can do that just with Bluetooth, right? Like, you can just...
Yeah.
Man, that's cool. I want to get like a little one of those little connectors that lets you put the phone above the controller and then just play it.
Yeah, that would be badass, right? You just carry it around with you and you're playing these games. And it's just like a treasure trove of games. It seems like an incredible deal if you need more games to play.
Yeah, that's the thing.
Which we all do. We've all been like, what is there? There's no video games.
I know.
So thank goodness.
Just really needed
some
games.
It got me thinking, like, Apple is an interesting company and just a strange company and a bad company for the video game industry in a lot of ways, because even though mobile gaming wound up opening up games to a huge audience, which is fantastic, and the more people are able to play games, the better, it also wound up devaluing games to a huge audience. And it got to the point, I'll never forget this, when I had a conversation with a friend of mine a few years ago, and this person is not into games at all, but she plays a couple of things on her phone, and I was like to her, oh, you should check out this game. I think it was Threes, actually, that I was telling her to get, and she was like, oh, okay, I'll check it out. And she pulls up her phone and the App Store and looks for it, and it's like $3. And she's like, I'm not going to pay $3 for a game. What are you talking about? Like, all my games are free. So yes. I think
a lot
Apple
of people
has
have a story like that.
So I think Apple has devalued games to that point. And something that I've talked about on the show and we've all discussed is like subscription services in general risk devaluing games to a really dangerous point if you care about the future of video games and the health of the people who make games and the way that games are made. Is Apple Arcade going, like, does Apple Arcade risk doing something similar, or is it not even something to worry about because on the mobile store, like in that world, most people don't want to pay for games anyway, so like $5 a month is even that is like,
I mean,
that's what
I was gonna say, like, it's already a space where mobile games are kind of screwed because they already have to be predicated on the assumption that people aren't going to want to pay for them, so like all of these games have to focus on getting noticed in that economy but also having their own internal economy that acknowledges that people won't want to spend money and then either tricks them into doing that or like has to incentivize it in a variety of good to disgusting ways, and that entire system is obviously terrible for those developers. I think we could all agree on that. And so for them, a subscription service actually seems like a boon in a way that it wouldn't necessarily be on another platform. But like, if mobile game developers are already in this horrible situation, it's like, great. If people are willing to pay $5 a month for games that they ideally don't have microtransactions or pay-to-win mechanics or any of these other things. I haven't played every Apple Arcade game. I don't know. But I'm assuming you pay, you got the game, you're done. Right. Like, that's already a step up from where a lot of mobile games were.
That's true.
Yeah, I mean, one of the problems, though, and this is something I've heard from developers in the past, is that if you're making a game and you're putting it on the subscription service of some sort, you are kind of capping yourself out, and you're like preventing your ability from becoming the next Minecraft. You're putting a ceiling on your sales because there are no sales. It's just like subscribers. And I'm not sure, actually, Evan, I should ask someone I know who's doing this if they get any royalties based on the number of subscribers or downloads of their game or something like that. But I know that Apple paid up front large amounts to people to be on this service. So I'm not sure about the back end. But either way, you're kind of like you're sabotaging your future sales potential almost by participating in something
maybe,
like this, which is a
weird
problem.
But there's maybe more stability? I don't know.
Yeah, no, totally. That's what you sacrifice. Or that's what you get out
of it. Question for clarification. Are these games available for sale as well, or are they only on the streaming service, on Apple devices? Because I know like the Simogo game is also on Switch, and I think it's on PS4.
Right, that's true. They're on other platforms.
But you can't buy that on iPhone and just play it? You have to subscribe to the subscription service to play it? Is that true for all the games on the service?
No. So you cannot actually buy these games separately in the App Store. Everything made in the Apple Arcade is designed to be just an Apple Arcade game, straight up.
But they're also, some of them are on other platforms as well.
Right, like you can buy
You could buy them there.
Yep. Yes, they can be on other platforms, but you cannot sell them in the App Store separately. Something else worth noting, by the way, is that the rollout of Apple Arcade has actually been something of a debacle. And what happened was they had an iPhone 11 announcement event last week, and they talked about Apple Arcade a bunch and just wound up sharing the names of a bunch of games in a press release afterwards, and kind of cut the legs out of a lot of developers who I think were planning on announcing their games on their own separately. So that kind of sucked for those folks. But it was funny that one day when we just got this inbox like press release, and it was just like a new game from the makers of Bravely Default and like all this other stuff that nobody had heard of before. And then this week they released a beta version or some early access version of Apple Arcade that nobody knew was actually coming. And apparently some developers were planning on releasing the final patches for their games or the final builds for their games when the service actually launched. So they weren't prepared. And so like people wound up getting early unfinished versions of some of these games. So it was just kind of a disaster, which also speaks to the way that Apple cares about and curates games.
I think that we're about to enter, and I feel like this fall is going to be an inflection point for streaming services. This is my sense, because the Disney thing launches, Apple's TV service launches.
Yeah.
HBO Max is the one that I'm just now hearing about. And that is the time Warner Media streaming service that I believe does not have all of the same shows as HBO Now. And I think they're going to coexist. And like then there's the fact that this Picard show is coming out on CBS All Access. And like as a TNG fan, I am like absolutely going to watch that. But then, and the Disney stuff sounds great. And now
NBC just did a new one with Battlestar Galactica revival or something. Oh,
so like there's all, so we're reaching this point where it is crazy expensive if you're going to have all of that stuff. You know, we get our internet through Comcast, and like, I think like our TV is almost free, but it's thrown in there too. So we're also paying for cable. And now if we're talking about like an Apple streaming service, like I'm definitely not going to sign up for this, but then again, or at least I wasn't planning on it. But when I think, well, I could just pay $5 and like I could play a couple of those games.
Yeah, but
like,
could you pay $5 12 times?
Right. Could I pay $60 is the real question. And then suddenly the answer is no. Mm. And like, I don't know, like I'm doing Apple Music now, which means I had to increase, like that's a pretty great music service, but I had to increase my storage with Apple. So now I'm paying, I think, $3 a month with them to get more online storage. So then there's this question of, it's just another $5 more, which I'm not going to do, but I could see someone making that argument. And it's also diffuse that it's very difficult to just sit down and look at the number. I feel like there needs to be, and maybe this exists, and if it does exist, I'll find out about it and tell people next week. There should just be an online service, like a website, like a calculator that you can
manages all your subscriptions.
It just tells you, it just gives you a big number on the screen of how much money you're paying every month to subscription streaming services.
Oh, I thought you were going to go somewhere else with that. Like a database that tells you what's available on which platform, and then you can like see what the actual most beneficial cocktail would be according
to your
interests.
Oh, that would be useful too. Like a version of Can I Stream It that actually works. Well, Can I Stream It exists, but Can I Stream It sucks. Or it's never been accurate.
There's no good service for this. This is a niche.
Yeah.
Well, if you Google, whenever you Google like where could I watch whatever show or whatever movie on streaming, there's always a billion like SEO bait sites.
I know, and
you click them
useless.
And they're all
I don't
all
look forward
useless.
To this being a gaming future at all, because it's like already ruined
where can
everything
I stream
else
Gears
and so
5?
Like now we would have to worry about that.
You know, it's funny because the whole launcher thing is not like you don't have to pay for the Epic Games Store, you don't have to pay the new Rockstar one that they just announced.
Not yet.
But there is still that feeling of, and it's the feeling of like, oh well, where can I even get this game that I want? Is it on this? Is it on that? What platform is it on? Mm-hmm. It's all related to the same feeling of like, well, this is only on PS4.
I had that exact experience this week with Control, which is gonna be on Steam eventually. But so I had to sit there and be like, well, should I get it on the Epic Store? Because, you know, Epic is evil. And I had had to really consider.
It really weigh your options. Anyways, that's my main thought. Every time a new one of these things is announced, I look at this fall and think, I'm about to sign up for a bunch more of these. I want to do that calculator and just come up with how much money, but I guess between me and Emily, we're paying each month for this stuff, because man, it is getting expensive, and that's not going to last.
Well, you know what? I'll show you my cable bill. It'll make you feel better. The amount
I don't know. They might be comparable, but yeah, it feels like it's not going to last. We'll see.
Yeah, because there's no way to get NFL Red Zone standalone as of right now, at least where I am, unfortunately. Anyway, why don't we take this listener question? Maddie, do us the honors.
Sure. Okay, so this is from Annie, who writes, "Hello, Jason, Maddie, and Kirk. I've been a longtime fan of the podcast, and I wanted to ask you guys something kind of silly. I'll keep this brief, but for context, I've been playing a lot of Assassin's Creed Odyssey since I bought it last week. I know, I'm very late to the party."
I feel like Maddie can relate to that.
Yeah, right. Whatever. We don't judge here. The Assassin's Creed games are timeless. You can pick them up anytime.
The party is always going.
Origins, still a great game. Anyway. Back to Annie's letter. "One of my favorite parts of the game is the mercenary bounty hunter tier system. Since my first mercenary kill, I've made it a tradition for myself and my friends that play the game with me to throw the body of every defeated mercenary into the nearest body of natural water as if it were a sign of respect. We also salute the screen and fire a single arrow into the sky. We will do this even if we are in a pretty landlocked territory of the game. There is absolutely no real purpose to doing this. It's just hilarious to us, and we do it solely out of tradition. So my question is this: do you guys have any weird unscripted video game traditions, i.e. things that you'll always do that aren't required in the game at all? I wish I had one that was even close to this good."
So I think, first of all, I want to open this up to our listeners. So email us your traditions at splitscreen@kotaku.com, because I'm very curious to hear people's crazy, weird video game tradition.
And it has to be so, and the rules here are, it has to not have anything to do with the game. It has
to be like Annie's incredible example.
Yes.
So I actually think my theory here is that the only time you would do a tradition like this is if you're with other people. And so Annie's playing this game with other people. I think people do this in like MMOs or like Destiny. Like, I'm sure we could think of some weird thing we've done at some
that
point
was
in Destiny.
So, and that was my thought, was the closest is some of the emotes that I'll do in Destiny. Like things where you'll run up to a boss and start dancing in their face, and you just kind of do it every time you fight them. Like, because like you said, I had the same thought, Jason, that this is a social thing, and that's the way she describes we always do this because it's such a fun shared ritual. Like doing it alone, like it feels a little more psychotic.
it's like
I always stab the guy I killed a bunch of times for good measure. You know, it's like it's like a little weirder maybe when you're doing it by yourself.
But that said, I mean, I know that there are people out there who have like weird Skyrim rituals where they fill their houses and have to organize everything, or like put cheese in every house, or like there are all sorts of stories out there from people. And I don't have any. I don't know if you guys have any.
I mean, this doesn't quite qualify because it's not a funny one. But I remember when I played the Tomb Raider reboot, which is a solo game, played it by myself. There's that cutscene really early on where Lara doesn't shoot the deer and she like cuddles it after. Well, she does kill it. It dies. And then she like cuddles it and she like feels really bad that she had to kill it. And so for the entire rest of the game, I didn't kill any animals at all except for the ones that attack you first, because I was like, she's not supposed to kill them. I guess she's not supposed to kill the animals. I don't know. And like at some point I found out that I was supposed to kill the animals, and I was just like, you know what? I haven't been killing them this whole time. I'm just going to go ahead and not kill any of them ever. And that was like how I played the entire game for no real reason. But that's more just me being like, I enjoy role playing in a game, which Annie's question definitely gets at. Like the fun of being like, okay, so my character is like this absurd mercenary. Like, what would she do? Like, would she do this really strange ritual? Like, yeah, Cassandra totally would do that. Like, it seems legit.
There's probably Grand Theft Auto things like that, right? I feel like there was definitely a period when I first started playing Grand Theft Auto 4, which at the time just like blew my face off, like with just how realistic it was. I just remember being like, what the fuck? And I think this was a common thing, is I would like obey all the traffic laws because I just didn't even know when I first started playing it. I was like, I just don't know if I'm going to get pulled over for running a red light in this game. Like, I don't know how deep the simulation goes. And of course, now I just fly through traffic in those games. But there is always, that's a little different. I guess it's not quite a tradition, but I bet that people do have traditions like that.
It'll be fun to hear from people. people.
Yeah, so I want to hear about it. And I'm sure it's people playing a game like that with their friends. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think if, like, when you and I have played, like, Dark Souls or Bloodborne together, Kirk, if we had any traditions. But I don't think we did, probably because we weren't playing it consistently.
Your Dark Souls tradition is just run through everything really, really reckless and fast, yeah, and somehow cheese bosses on accident. That's Jason Schreier's.
Oh, I had it. My tradition that we've talked about before was that in Destiny PvP, whenever I killed someone with a shotgun, I would sing the Indiana Jones theme song.
It would always be Jason with the shotgun coming through, and then there comes the Raiders theme over my headphones.
Oh man, that's good. That's making me nostalgic. I miss Destiny. I miss our Destiny PvP days, man. Soon. If only I didn't have a child.
You're gonna be fine. You're gonna be fine. You'll still be able to play some.
Anyway, let's take a break and then get into some off-topic stuff.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
And we are back. Kirk, Maddie, let's talk about the things we are doing that have nothing to do with video games. Kirk, start us off.
All right. My thing for this week is Mindhunter Season 2, which I finished last week, a little late last week. And I liked okay. I thought it was like a little bit less focused or less interesting or something. It just seemed like they weren't totally sure what to do with Season 2 of that show. But I do still like it. Have you watched this show, the first season?
Yeah, I watched the first season.
You did? Okay,
the second season is in my Netflix queue.
I watched the pilot and thought it was terrible. So.
Oh, okay.
It's a strange show. But Kirk, go ahead.
It is a strange show.
He was talking to this girl and it was terrible dialogue and terrible acting and it was really just boring.
Yeah, I don't know if I agree with that. I think the cast is good. What's cool about the second season, I actually really didn't like that storyline in season one, the main guy, whatever his name is, mm-hmm. Jonathan Groff's character, which is like, side note, that is the weirdest thing about this show, that Jonathan Groff plays the main character. He is, you know Jonathan Groff, right? He's like, he played King George in Hamilton. He's like a Broadway guy. Like he was mm-hmm. in... Mm-hmm. He's in, actually just saw a profile of him or an article about him. He's in Little Shop of Horrors right now. He's playing Seymour.
Seymour?
And
yeah.
And yet he's playing this like...
Seymour?
He's playing this disaffected like serial killer hunter weirdo guy on Mindhunter. It's very funny.
I think he's supposed to be awkward, Jason, but that's part of what makes the first season tough to watch is that he is so awkward and strange.
And like that story, like there's, so the first season kind of revolves around them starting up. What the show is about, just mm-hmm. to tell people really quick, is like the FBI started this division, I think it was in like the late 70s, to like study serial killers. They called them sequence killers. They didn't even have
right.
a pathology
for it.
They
didn't have a term for it yet. So it's right. like about the history of the creation of the term serial killer and the right. people who initially studied them. It's like inspired by a nonfiction book about this, if I recall
right.
correctly.
Mm. And so basically, it's like a serial killer thing in the vein of, you know, Silence of the Lambs or whatever, but it's not, at least season one was very much not about the hunt for a serial killer. It was much more about like studying serial killers who have been captured and understanding them. And so it's not a lot of like gory imagery. It's more just like unsettling psychologically because there are people talking really frankly about the people they killed and it's mm-hmm. scary, but it isn't like shock value and like strung up bodies and stuff. It's
right.
a different kind of serial killer.
Deep monologues by people portraying real serial killers, which
right.
I would say that's the more interesting part of the show. It's like seeing
totally
actors
agree.
Get to chew scenery by playing actual serial killers. That
right. Especially that main guy from season one. He was incredible.
Yes.
And so season two is, what I didn't like about season one is that there's a big storyline that you were referencing, Jason, that's about the main guy, Holden, that's his name, and like his relationship with this woman and how he's kind of this repressed weirdo in his normal life and how it kind of like connects the two parts of his life and how he's starting falling apart by the end as he's studying these, you know, mentally ill people. And that was just sort of like, it wasn't as interesting to me. And I didn't really like her. I thought she was just kind of like not a well fleshed out character. And it was kind of a thankless role. Season two focuses on the other two characters, on Anna Torv and the other, his partner. And that's cool because they're interesting characters. His partner gets a storyline. But there's parts of it that like, it's interesting. Like I like what they're trying to do, but it just feels more scattered. Like Charles Manson shows up. There's more like serial killers that you know. Son of Sam is in it. And
oh, wow.
It,
big year for Charles Manson.
There will be. Yeah, it, I believe it's the same guy playing Charles Manson as played him in the Quentin Tarantino movie. I'm not sure about that, but I think I saw that somewhere. Anyways, it was cool. It's an interesting show. It feels a little more like they don't totally know what they're doing. There's more of a, there's like an actual serial killer they're trying to catch, and they're still intercutting the stuff with BTK, the like bind, torture, kill killer from Kansas, and it's not clear where that's going. And it's a show that I continue to watch, even though it is like this grim, gray downer. I find it compelling, even though there are things about it that don't totally work for me. But it's still a cool show. Like I'll be curious what you think of it, Maddie, if you manage to watch it.
I'll probably get around to it. I enjoyed the first season enough that, I don't know. It's not like a must watch for me, but I'm curious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I know what you mean.
By the way, side note, Kirk, I think I will use my paternity leave as an opportunity to finally watch The Wire.
Oh, that's exciting.
You've never seen The Wire? Are you even a reporter, Jason?
It's the one classic show.
It's an ongoing thing with me and Jason.
All-time great that I haven't seen yet.
It's like every journalist I've ever met in my life is obsessed with The Wire.
Every writer,
it's like one of those
just in general.
Shows. Yeah. Anyway.
Well, it's because anytime I want to watch anything, I just wind up watching The Sopranos again for the 20th time. So
replace it with The Wire. It's like a perfect one-to-one switch. It's fine. It's another
Maddie, what
drama.
About you? What are you watching these days?
Yeah, I watched Chernobyl. I'm technically halfway through the last episode. There's only five. But I see where it's going, I guess.
What kind of deviant stops a show in the middle of an episode?
I just haven't finished it yet.
I can't do this. I don't understand. My wife does this also. I can't understand people who start watching an episode knowing that they're not going to be able to finish. I have to watch the whole thing, like in one sitting.
Depends
on
the show.
I guess I organize my time differently than you, because sometimes I don't have 43 minutes at a stretch to watch an episode. And also, Chernobyl is a show that benefits from taking breaks. I don't think I watched any of the episodes in one go, because
it's kind of exhausting.
Sometimes they get real spooky or weird or just start stressing me the heck out. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, I need to take a break from this. So I actually remember pausing it at a point when the episode got really stressful and being like, I'm gonna pick this up later. Like, I did that a few times with this show.
Fair enough.
I enjoyed it. Not sure if that's the right way to describe this show, but I did get a lot out of it because I didn't know a lot about the Chernobyl disaster. I knew the vague terms of what had happened, but not really any details. So I watched it. I looked up a bunch of articles about what wasn't accurate about it and what was accurate about it. Was horrified by the things that were accurate and surprised by some of the things they changed and thought about why they changed them, and just overall found it really interesting. I recommend the show. It's obviously tragic. You have to deal with dogs dying, babies dying, women and children dying, watching people's hair fall out from radiation. But they actually cut away from a lot of stuff. I was expecting to see a lot more vomiting and people getting killed on camera, and they don't really do that. They mostly just have the emotional toil be what you're dealing with, and there's no vomit shown on the show. I was just pleasantly surprised by that. People were telling me there's going to be a lot of vomiting. I was like, I'm ready. I'm ready for some cans of soup to be thrown at the screen in Chernobyl. It's not like that at all. It's not
have
that
you,
kind of show.
Did you listen to the podcast, the accompanying podcast?
I didn't. Is it good?
Yeah, it's cool. It's a little bit like it's by HBO, so it has a little bit of that feel of like the way those behind the episodes, Game of Thrones interviews, where it's like, wasn't the show great? Here's how great we are.
Yeah, stuff like that tires me out sometimes.
But I liked it. I think I listened to all of them. They're short. Peter Sagal's doing the interviewing, which is nice just because I like listening to Peter Sagal talk. And it's cool because they get into a lot of the stuff you're talking about, like why they change things. And it's the showrunner, and he's like explaining, usually pretty
why
frankly, about like, oh, this was a composite character because whatever reason, you know. They weren't a real person. But radiation just freaks
me out.
It's
messed up, man.
It just freaks me out.
That's my
terrifying.
Take on it.
It makes my skin crawl.
It's bad.
That's the thing.
Having seen Chernobyl, I think it might be bad. I don't know.
But like really, like watching the show, that's the thing that like gets under my skin. Like
it's terrifying.
Is the feeling of
it gets on the outside of your skin. But
then it gets
but
into
then
your
it
body.
Gets
no, but you know, it's that's like true. Just that the, watching the people like that to me, like I get what you're it's just a claustrophobic feeling.
And like the idea of like a person infecting another person with this like unseeable thing. It's
terrifying to me anyway.
Anyway.
So on a more cheerful note, last Thursday night, I went with my buddy Drew, who is a listener, a Split Screen listener. Shout out to Drew. We went to go see Not Another D&D podcast live. And longtime fans of Split Screen might remember I gave them a couple shout outs back when they were first starting out last year or 2 years ago. And they become this huge thing. And so this is a podcast. It's like a comedy D&D podcast. It's in my regular rotation. They do a really good job. It's a few folks with college humor backgrounds. I expected it to be, it was at this theater in Times Square, and I expected it to be kind of like maybe half full, and I get there and it's like packed to the brims, and people are wearing costumes from the show and like shouting out, and like I kept getting nerd chills because like every time they would do something people would just go crazy. Like that, I was sitting in front of one particularly raucous woman who kept getting really excited and everything.
That's awesome.
And I very much enjoyed it, although it is a weird experience seeing a podcast live. As I'm sure Split Screen listeners who came out to our live shows have seen, but especially at D&D podcast live, because I really just wanted to be like sitting there and like playing threes the whole time and on the subway or something, because it's just such an unfamiliar.
I have to watch them.
I feel like there was someone who literally did that during our live show, who was like, I'm playing threes because that's what I do usually when I listen to your podcast. I'm sitting in the audience and playing threes.
That's so funny. But there was a lot of fun, and I'm happy for them that they found such success with their show. It's really, really, really cool because their show is fantastic, and everyone should go listen to it. Nad Pod. And now it is time for the NFL story of the week. This one will be pretty short, but I have to share it because we are, of course, keeping up on the legend of Gardner Minshew II, who, fun fact, that he is called Gardner Minshew II, even though there is no Gardner Minshew I. His father's name is Flint Minshew.
Makes no sense.
Gardner Minshew. I don't know if you guys have seen a picture of him, but he has this ridiculous mustache and just like looks like
the opposite.
You showed
us a picture. You've already forgotten that you did this, but you did.
Oh, I did. Okay,
good.
Picture of him. He's a legend. So, quick backstory in case people aren't familiar: Nick Foles, legendary backup quarterback who won a Super Bowl, finally got his own team with the Jacksonville Jaguars, went down to injury last week, is out for a while, and so his backup came in, and now it's like the backup to the backup. Gardner Minshew, who's this fascinating character, sixth round pick out of Washington State, he comes out, he plays his ass off. So week two is on Sunday, and I actually had a bet that involved this game that would have been really nice if this game had won, but we'll get to that in a second. So Gardner Minshew comes out and he plays. It's the Jaguars are playing the Houston Texans. I almost said the Texas Texans, which would be a great name for a football team. But no, it was the Houston Texans. They're going back and forth. It's a pretty low scoring game. Winds up being, I believe it was 13-7. That doesn't make sense. It would have been 13-6. And Gardner Minshew takes control of the game, is suddenly like playing on fire, like scrambling around, throwing balls to receivers that he should not be throwing, like making ridiculous plays. He's like driving him down the field in one of the best performances I've ever seen. Finally, he like pulls off this tremendous fourth down play, eventually scores a touchdown. So now the score, a touchdown, as you guys know, is 6 points. So now the score is 13-12. So traditionally what you would do here is you would kick an extra point. There's basically no time remaining. So you kick a point, take the game to overtime. But Doug Marrone, who is the coach of the Jacksonville Jaguars, whose last name, not coincidentally, is the same as the expletive that Tony Soprano and crew like to shout a lot. Oh, Marrone. He takes his guys out on the field for a two-point conversion. So a two-point conversion in football is where instead of just kicking an extra point, which is considered pretty easy, you are actually pulling another play, and you have to score basically a touchdown from like the five-yard line or so in just a single play. And it's very risky, but if you do it, you get 2 points instead of one. So oftentimes, strategically, it's smart to do it for all sorts of reasons. If you need to catch up on the scoreboard, if you just want to rack up points, people do it for lots of different reasons. But in this scenario, it's not very likely. So I actually really like this call because it's like you have Gardner Minshew. He's super hot. He's like playing out of his mind. Continue the legend, like build up his confidence, like get the whole team just rallying around this guy who is ridiculous. So the Jaguars come out and Gardner Minshew snaps the ball and he takes the ball and he hands it off to his running back, who immediately gets stuffed at the goal line, and bam, game over, they lose.
Wow. Like,
Doug Marone, the coach of the Jaguars, was so bad at coaching that he didn't even give the ball to his hot quarterback to like try to make him play. Like, he didn't even get an opportunity to try to make a play. He just handed it off. It was the worst thing I've ever seen. Made even more like bad by the fact that I actually had a parlay on the Colts and the Jaguars to win. They were both underdogs. The Colts had already won. The parlay paid like 9-1 odds. So I was very excited about this sequence of events and very, very ready for Gardner Minshew to just have a chance to throw the ball in the end zone and probably score. And yeah. Doug Marone just took it away. He ruined the legend of Gardner Minshew. And for that, I will never forgive Doug Marone, the worst football coach in the league right now. Shout out to Doug Marone. Also, side note, completely unrelated to this, during the same game, he got into, they have this incredible cornerback, Jalen Ramsey, who's like one of their star players. And Doug Marone got into a screaming match with Jalen Ramsey during this game, to the point where Jalen Ramsey has now asked for a trade. So this coach is just like the worst. Wow. You would think that like they would be able to find decent football coaches, but alas. Anyway, so that's the NFL story of the week. Kirk, give us your music pick.
All right. Well, Strong Songs is Aretha Franklin this week. It's Think, which has already been a music pick on this show, because I just love that song so much. I want everyone to listen to it.
It's so a great song.
It's a great song, man. She's amazing. And I've been listening to a ton of Aretha over the last week. And there's so much good stuff that people don't know. And so my music pick is a different Aretha Franklin song from a little bit later. This is from her album Young, Gifted, and Black in 1972. It's a tune called Rock Steady. It's got Bernard Purdy on drums, and he has this drum breakdown that I'll include in this clip. It's super, super good. Here is Aretha Franklin singing Rock Steady. Amazing. She changed the world of music. I love her. She has an incredible voice. The end. Aretha.
Kirk, when you listen to music, do you tend to listen to it and just listen to music and like not do anything else except focus? Or like do you listen while you're doing other stuff?
I have like a whole routine. I sometimes lie on the floor and stare at the ceiling. I find that's a very good way to listen to music, like on headphones, because the ceiling has a little bit going on. So my eyes kind of move around, but I'm mostly focusing. And I go on walks a lot, which I really love doing. Like just put on an album. Don't listen to podcasts. Don't get on the phone. Like, just put on an album, start to finish, and like walk up Mount Tabor. And that is like an amazing way to spend an hour in the afternoon. So yeah, I do try to do really focused listening and not just have it on the background.
Cool. All right. I think that is it for this week's episode. Kirk, Maddie, I will see you next week, or maybe I won't see you.
Or maybe not. Ooh, good luck. Or maybe.
To be determined. To be determined.
Very excited.
Cool.
See you both in a week. Or not.
See ya.
Bye.
Kotaku Split Screen is an official podcast of Kotaku.com. It's produced by Jason Schreier, Maddie Myers, and me, Kirk Hamilton. I edit and mix the podcast and also wrote and performed our theme song and other music. We're a part of the Fusion Podcast Network, where Mandana Mofidi is executive producer of audio. You can find us on popular podcast services like Panoply, NPR One, Google Play, and Apple Podcasts, and we hope that you'll leave us a review if you like what you hear. Find old episodes at Kotaku.com/splitscreen. Email us at splitscreen@kotaku.com.
Look around. You can find cars like these on AutoTrader. New cars, used cars, electric cars, maybe even flying cars. Okay, no flying cars, but as soon as they get invented, they'll be on AutoTrader. Just you wait. AutoTrader.